Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Cheryl Dumanil. Cheryl Dumanil is the editor of Hitched, Wedding Stories from San Francisco City Hall, and co-editor of Dorothy Parker's Elbow, Tattoos on Writers, Writers on Tattoos. Her new book, entitled In Praise of Falling, is the winner of the 2008 Agnes Lynch Starrett Poetry Prize from the University of Pittsburgh Press and was published in 2009. Her poems have appeared in Calix, Indiana Review, and Many Mountains Moving, among other publications. Hi, Cheryl. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good. And happy that you're here from San Francisco.
It's good to be in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So you're going to read from your new book, In Praise of Falling.
Yeah, I'm going to read. I'm going to start with the first poem from the book. It's a poem that I wrote at a time when I was really thinking about the nature of mistakes and thinking about how it's the unconscious mistakes that seem to have the biggest consequences because we're not paying attention when we make them. It's not Armageddon, spreading amber fog from north to south across a September sky. And no, that's not a metaphor for depression or the slow death of love, not even with its signature reference to the season of falling leaves. It's just smoke from a brush fire 200 miles away, staining sunlight the color of white sheets soaked in a rusty bin. It's just a stupid mistake. A guy in his yard burning leaves, a spark from a gas-powered mower, that old crow bottle smashed in a dry field, finally finding its flame, with a consequence writ large enough for satellites to photograph from space. It's just ash dusting the parking lot, like dandruff brushed from the shoulder of an itchy god. The second poem I'd like to read is called Atlantis, and it was written when I was living in San Francisco, but pretty much any city I visit, one of the most inspiring things I find about the city is riding the public transportation. It's one of my most consistent inspirations. Atlantis. Rush hour, leaving the last downtown station. Our train descends under San Francisco Bay, and I imagine we are Atlantis sinking. This populace of stockbrokers snapping evening papers, file clerks lacing sneakers onto tired, stocking feet. We're all going down together. The brown-skinned girl wearing fuchsia sweats, thumbs working the buttons of her video game, and the green power suit who leans against a closed door, flips out her cell phone, dials home to say she's running late, cusses under her breath when the straight train slows to a crawl. See the girl slouched in that corner seat, notepad lying open on her lap. She's scribbling, scribbling as if she could keep us alive by recording all our details right. The wingspan of a boy stretching his yawn, arched eyebrow penciled on a sleeping woman's face. As if fingernail by callus, ripped skirt by sideburn, bottom lip by butterfly tattoo, she could raise us up from the depths, silver, glimmering. So following on the theme of public transportation, that'll show up again in this poem. The next poem I'm going to read was sparked when I listened to a news show that contained these two facts. One was they figured out what was causing the statue of the Virgin Mary to cry. And the other fact was that they could trace back the lineage of this guy in L.A. who was making gains as a rapper, they could trace his lineage back to Confucius. And so when those kinds of things show up in a news program like that, they beg to be written about. So this is the result of hearing those two facts. Don't miss it. Turns out the tears the virgin statue eked out from the corners of her eyes were insect secretions. Mary has been eaten by bugs from the inside. Don't worry, pumpkin. Alternative miracles arrive on the subway platform in 20-minute intervals every day. No lie. In this lifetime, a descendant of Confucius takes the shape of an LA-based rapper dropping knowledge in English and Cantonese. What I'm saying is, keep watch, sweet thing. If the good books pan out in that theory to practice sort of way, You could find Buddha sitting beside you on the L train. In fact, you already have. The next poem I'm going to read is inspired by something that I saw happen in a neighborhood in San Francisco. I named the poem after that neighborhood. It's called Bernal Heights. Knit cap rolled down to eyebrows, corduroys slouched below hip bones. The boy leaned into Good Life Grocery's door, yelled to the butcher, "Yo, cops took us fishing. Look at here." His fingers threaded the salmon's gills, an arc of silver lifted in the air. "Sell it to you, $20. The butcher shook a grin onto his face, said, "Way to go, Jackpot," a name that stuck for life. And they laughed like water, like last night's take of nickels falling in the slot machine's mouth. And Jackpot nudged out the doorway, strutting up the street, his image flashing in storefront windows, that fish swinging from his hand like a comet fallen to earth, a song of luck, of winning.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Cheryl Dumanil. She's reading from her new book, In Praise of Falling. I like the statements that seem to arrive in the middle of your poems, often after description, like, you know, when you say no, it's not a metaphor for depression, or, you know, just these statements that seem to sort of emerge in the poem, and yet they don't feel like commentary to me at all. They feel like, you know, an integral part of the poem. So I was wondering, I think that's really hard to do. I was wondering how you have the, you know, how you get the confidence to allow those voices to come in, and how conscious that is when you're writing to have those voices come in.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how conscious it is. The more questions I get asked about my writing, the more I realize that, you know, I check the decisions after they've come onto the page. I check them and I revise them, but I don't always know how it gets there in the first place. But for me, there's a rhythm between description and comment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those statements come through with a force that that I just can't really deny the force of it. It needs to be there. It's kind of sassy sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes it's a little sarcastic. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's this urge to do the opposite of what someone might expect to have happen next. Mm-hmm. But that's all gut instinct and kind of after the fact that I can describe that. The poem Don't Miss It is really kind of told in two voices. Half of it is italicized to indicate the two voices. And part of that is because that voice came so strongly through me into that poem that I almost didn't have the confidence to stand up with that poem, because I felt like, well, who am I to tell people what to miss and what not to miss? It's kind of over authoritative. Mm-hmm. It's more than I would say. I don't like to give people advice. Mm-hmm. I like to ask them questions as a person. Mm-hmm. But as a poet, sometimes those voices just come through and I have to surrender to it and stand up next to it when mm-hmm. it's time.
When you say the voices come through, especially for our audience, who some of whom are writers and some of whom may not be, what do you mean the voices come through?
I mean, it sounds kind of like mystical.
Yeah, you're channeling.
Mystical or crazy. honestly, sometimes, not to sound too self-aggrandizing, but sometimes it does feel like something coming through. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was Robert Frost who talked about listening to the rhythms of poems and trying to attach the words to the rhythms. It's like listening to a conversation through a wall. So you can hear the rhythm, but you can't hear the distinct words. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like often that's what my thought process is when the poems are actually coming onto the page, is that I just need to concentrate hard enough to hear what those words are that are wanting to get onto the page. And I feel the rhythm first sometimes, and then the words come.
Do you think that's a function of riding the BART system too much? It's like
and the rhythm of the clackety clack is under there somewhere. It's entirely possible.
But I mean, because you kept bringing up public transportation, mm-hmm. And you have this collision of stories in your poems with, you know, I really like where the rapper meets the Virgin Mary in that one poem. Mm-hmm. And is that something that you do often is, you know, join two seemingly unlike stories?
I love that.
Yeah.
I love reading that. I love when it happens to me. You know, that I mean, that those two facts showed up together. How could I not do something with that? You know, they were begging for it.
Okay.
And I think it's being awake to those things happening, to those synchronicities or those cacophonies that happen that are meaningful, to those juxtapositions, those unlike juxtapositions. Like, I was looking out my hotel room window earlier today, and I'm by a hospital, and a medevac helicopter was coming in. And as the medevac helicopter was moving across my view, it scared up these pigeons that were then, you know, flying their loops in the sky and then returning back to the side of this brick building. And to me, that's a juxtaposition of the mechanical and the diagonal line, you know, the straight diagonal line, and this motion of these pigeons, and the pigeons also being flight but being organic, mm-hmm. in both in their motion and being organic beings. Mm-hmm. That's got to turn into something somewhere.
Okay.
You know, I love that. That's what really attracts my attention are those surprises.
Well, maybe you have a Pittsburgh poem.
Yeah. the acrobats of Pittsburgh coming soon to a literary magazine near you.
That's right. Okay, could you read that poem that you were talking about, the with the two voices?
Oh, that was the poem that I read.
Oh, that you read. Okay.
Yeah, don't miss it.
Oh, okay. Well, could you read some more then?
Sure. Let's see what comes up next. So you had actually asked me to read that poem, Chosen.
Mm-hmm.
The middle section, or the second section of my book, is kind of coming of age poems, and this one appears in that section. Chosen. Dust and brown leaves blowing across the soccer field. A traffic light bouncing on its pole. The gusting wind suddenly cool. I roll up the window, slam the car into park, run up the driveway yanking quilts off the clothesline. I'd seen it coming, smoky clouds billowing over the hill, crawling our way. The screen door slaps in its frame, and I find her curled on the bed, waiting. When she was 6 years old, they told her the world would end like this. A muscled beast filling her sky, thunder rattling glass panes. Her father hoarded blankets, stashed bottled water, canned beans under his bed. He packed a St. Christopher medal in her lunchbox, hung the worn thread of a scapular around her neck as she left for school. He told her, when it happens, he will appear as a bright light, turn away from windows. Only the chosen will be saved. I drop the quilts on the floor and lie down beside her, sweep hair from her collar, kiss her damp neck. A thunder blast, the first white bolt. I slide my hands inside her shirt and hold her. Yes, chosen. Yes, saved. The next poem I'm going to read, it actually appeared in a book that I edited called Dorothy Parker's Elbow, Tattoos on Writers, Writers on Tattoos, that I worked on with Kim Adonizio. And this was my contribution to that book, a poem about watching someone get tattooed. Triangle Tattoo. Wood planked floor, 12-foot ceiling, a wall of glossy snapshots. Dragonfly, water lily, barbed wire spiraling a woman's thigh. The artist bends over my love's shaved leg, his palette of paper cups filled with ink. Through her skin, three finches emerge on a blackberry branch, ink mixed with blood beating her calf. For the third time, I run downstairs to the car, slap the gear shift into neutral, roll over the parking cop's chalk mark, buying us time. Hours I sat beside them, telling stories, changing the music, rubbing color back into her fingertips. Now I lean against the car and listen. The buzz of his needle piercing her skin. the heart-shaped sign swinging its rusted chain. This is my job. He will change her body forever. I will love what she becomes. So after I finished up graduate school in Syracuse, New York, I rushed as quickly as I could back to California because putting a California girl in the middle of Syracuse, New York in the winter is a bad joke, and swore I was going straight to the San Francisco and I would never leave. And part of the celebration of that was hanging out in the Castro District. But also part of the underside of that is at that time you couldn't really hang out in the Castro District without being abundantly aware of AIDS losses and the struggle of the community around HIV and AIDS. So this poem is a moment of trying to lift up from that. Theories. The queen working the espresso maker tells me Karen Carpenter was actually Richard in drag. What they found crumpled in the corner of the closet was not her skeletal body, but his threadbare blouses. Wool skirts fallen from hangers, a persona disintegrating. I tell him Marilyn lives on Graceland's second floor. I stood at the red velvet ropes myself. I heard her humming. I pull up a stool. He polishes chrome to gleaming. We trade fictions. Love outlasts death. The universe never gives you more than you can take. Those who have gone live on in me. I drain my glass. He slings a damp rag over his shoulder, pours a refill on the house. When God closes a door, he opens a window on the 26th floor. In keeping with the theme of community coming together to hold each other up, I'll read Hard Labor. 6 o'clock alarm broke the morning open, and we choked down gas station coffee, drove to the lake, watched familiar cars creep up the gravel road, tired bodies carrying hammers, a cooler, charcoal, a red gas can. Then Terry fired up her neighbor's chainsaw, and we axed the storm-toppled maple to logs. Hours bagging damp brush, hauling branches to the road, wood glue and box screws to steady the weathered picnic table's legs. Then, after a tour of the latest additions, sheetrock walls for an upstairs bedroom, the cherry wood banister she found in some old man's barn. After scraping the grill, stacking briquettes, after coaxing the fire and everyone complaining, Terry does things the hard way. Her house an hour out of town, built by small paychecks and her own hands. After well-earned burgers and all the laughing, we agree we wouldn't give this up for anything. Aching muscles, swamp mud caking our shoes, sawdust ground into our palms, white corn steaming in its foil. After hard talk around the table about who's out and who's hiding, the young man beaten unconscious Friday night for wearing pink, and the unspoken wondering if any one of us is safe, we sat in silence on the dock edge, bare feet tapping rings into the lake, and watched a harvest orange moon rise through the trees, casting across the water a silver path anyone would take.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Cheryl Dumanil. She's reading from her new book, In Praise of Falling, winner of the 2008 Agnes Lynch Starrett Prize. It seems to me that your poetry sort of suggests, like it sets the stage for feeling, and sort of what you were saying before a little, that there's this balance of reporting and detail, but it seems there is a sense of restraint there. And another way of saying that is there's a lot of room for the reader to come in. Hmm. I don't know if that's how you look at your work, or if that's how I was going to say that's how you set it up. But I don't, you know, from what you've been saying, it seems like you don't plan a lot ahead of time, but then you revise afterwards.
Right. Let it come out the way it comes out the first time around. I just try to get out of the way the first time and then go in and see what I need to do. I don't think I really want to tell people what to think.
Right.
Maybe more offer something for them to come toward themselves.
So it's important for you as a writer to have that sort of open space for people to enter your work, because you have a lot of couplets in your book. There is a lot of white space.
There's a lot of space. Yeah, actually. And I write in blocks less and less. You know, that some of the narrative poems in here are written in a block. They're not stanzas. It's one block and it reads like a story. But I'm writing with more and more space. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is it's almost like spoon feeding. Take a little bit, take a little bit, take a little bit. And I think part of that, too, is because I don't want to overload people with details. And I tend to put a lot of details into the work. So the details are there for a reason. I want them to resonate a little bit before I move on.
Sure. Although there's that issue of, like, you don't know what the audience can take. You don't, you know, you say you don't want to overload us or the reader, and yet maybe the reader is obsessive and wants a lot of detail. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but even so, I like a lot of detail. But I like to have the space to absorb it before I move on to the next detail.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to write an overloading poem, if that was the general energy of the poem, I would do that.
Oh,
I would definitely do that if I wanted to mess with my reader in that way and say, this is too much, this is too much, this is too much.
Yeah,
you know,
good luck.
Sometimes that's your point. You know, this is too much, you know.
Then I
would do that too.
Yeah, so you take your cues again from the poem, always from the poem.
Yeah, I take the cues from the poem.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the reason that I don't work much in forms. I pay a lot of attention to the poetic elements that make up a form, but I don't work much in forms because I don't trust myself not to emphasize the form over the content. The one poem that's in here that's in a form is a pantoum that I actually wrote on the occasion of my dad's 60th birthday, which I don't write occasional poetry either. But my mom asked me to, and what do? You step up, right? But the reason that I ended up using a form for that one, because it's about my dad telling repetitive stories.
Yeah.
It called for a pantoum, but it's the only form in the book.
Mm-hmm. So if you said you didn't trust yourself to not – sort of be taken over in a way by the form or to pay too much attention to the form. But then couldn't you later always break the form and find the poem, right?
Yeah, which I've done.
Yeah,
I've done that too.
I think you're right. It is very difficult to write in form and not screw up a poem, you know, in that
and
way.
And there are incredible formal poems being written right now, today, you know, being published contemporarily. I'm just not one who trusts myself to do that yet.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't know the forms. It's not that I don't understand them.
Yeah.
But I think because I came up through free verse, what I look for is, you know, following the organic form that's in the seed that gets there rather than following the blueprint and putting my own style into the blueprint. It's something to experiment with. But anytime that I've experimented with form, I've felt a little bit detached from my subject matter because I'm trying to play by rules that came outside of myself.
Right.
That said, if I'm going through a period where I can't get anything out and I need something to shake me up, then I'll try a sonnet. What the heck? I mean, even if you just do the work with the turns in the sonnet, you know, so X number of lines presenting the problem, X number of lines, you know, you turn it every four lines. Even to put that kind of restriction on myself can cause me to surprise myself.
Right.
So anything that creates a surprise.
Right. But I mean, I like what you're saying. I mean, the poem wins. I mean, the poem is primary and not the form.
Yeah.
And also the flip side of that is we've also seen, you know, formal poems written today that are victims of form. So yeah, it's all across the board.
Yeah. And, you know, I think too, it's for me at the very root of my beginning writing, it was about breaking rules.
Right.
You know, and mostly breaking rules of what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say for a very personal process as a, you know, 19-year-old, 20-year-old. And so I think there's still that little rebel kid in me who's like, rules?
Not doing it.
No, thanks. You know, I'm going to pay a lot of attention, though, to to rhythm and to sound and to line length and to structure. I'm going to pay a lot of attention to that, and I'm going to squeeze that for everything it's worth. You know, I'm trying to pull out of language every slice of communicative power it has. So I'm going to use every trick that I can learn. I'm going to use it, you know. So I'm not ignoring form.
Okay. We have time for a couple more poems.
Okay. Okay. So speaking of breaking rules, this one's called Don't Ask Me. This one comes from the final section of the book, which there are poems about love starting, ending, relationships falling apart, figuring out why that happens, you know, the love questions. Don't ask me. Consider the empty bean can floating in creek muck, rust dazzling the jagged edge of its razor mouth. Or worms drowning in the soil in a clay pot with no drain hole, collecting rain all winter through. And the sunburst pattern of busted out windows in that brick warehouse on Carolina Street. Nothing lives there but mud, used condoms, shattered glass. Some things never make sense. The toilet backed up because it had to. Garage spiders crochet vortex webs between lawn power blades, utility sink legs, the wheels on my old suitcase. That's their job. Sometimes love is an ignition switch refusing to catch. This doesn't mean I'm leaving. 5 a.m., the neighbor's 73 Cadillac coughing exhaust plumes across the yard. Don't ask me to explain the metal flavor in the air or why this water tastes like bitter soap. Don't ask why hope is a tadpole swimming her infinite loop through that rusted can. When? I used to believe in signs. The ocean leaving something brittle and unbroken on the sand for me to find. Or the foghorn I heard from my dark bedroom after you told me to listen hazy mornings before dawn. That low moan guiding minor vessels away from craggy harm. If there were guarantees in love, then yes, I would follow you. To New York City, Puerto Rico, a place of birth, yours or mine. I used to believe in tides pulling bodies toward unknown purples and deep, deep greens. That a dream about blue whales signified desire, terrifying and good, rising in the body after a decade-long fight. Back then, I would track a dragonfly's crooked path across an August drought field, expecting cattails and water to emerge from the earth, and they would. When I believed in signs, a coyote pawing at dry brush, her tail a flag among weeds told me, I should look for you. And a black-tailed deer holding my gaze meant, if I could find you, you would stay.
It's the poetry of Cheryl Dumanil reading from her book In Praise of Falling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in this Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.